Welcome to Business Watch on this Friday the 13th. Ominous signs, but certainly so far nothing to be too afraid with the start that we've seen on the JSE. Wild swings in equity markets persist, with each leg taking the indexes lower. Over the in the US, we see the S&P now close to confirming bear market territory, which will be down 20%. Cryptos crashed on unstable coins. Meanwhile, the dollar surges and the rand's battle to keep up shows, with a loss of almost 11% to the greenback in a month, but only down just over 1.5% so far year to date. In the political economy, we've got a lack of mining cadastre system 10 years after the failure of SAMRAD, looming large over the mining in Darba. And today we still don't even have an adjudicated tender, and the integrity of the process already reeks of self-dealing and corruption. And we've had updates on the much-vaunted Operation Vulindlela and a rail policy white paper that hopes to get rail reform back on track. So lots to discuss with Warwick Lucas, head of Galileo Securities, Raymond Parsons, professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Isa Mslanger, chief economist at Alex Forbes. Warwick, every day another pillar falls in the advance and sent equities skywards months after the COVID outbreak. And I think strategists and technicians are now looking for signs of panic, heavy volume days, and other indicators that mark a psychological washout before you can really call the sell-off done and over. But so far, the all clear has been elusive. The big question, I guess, one has to answer is whether you see the US entering recession in 12 to 24 months. Do you?
Well, that's a bit of a long question there. I would say, Michael, that there's a reasonable possibility. After all, the kind of interest rate hikes that are going to be required is a pretty steep one. Now, it doesn't mean that that's guaranteed to cause a recession, but there's always some kind of risk of either policy error or some kind of market dislocation that can have a magnified effect when you're working in that kind of environment. So if nothing else, there's a heck of a lot of risk aversion out there that might in and of itself amount ultimately to a kind of a market event. So we've really got to be very, very careful.
Isa, do you see the US going into a recession over that period?
Look, I think it's quite clear now that central banks are increasingly feeling the urgency to control inflation. The major question is whether they will tolerate high inflation for longer to keep growth positive, or they will hike interest rates aggressively to tame inflation while risking the economy to enter into recession. You know, we saw this week uncharacteristically of presidents speaking on fighting inflation as their mandate. U.S. President Joe Biden expressed such to say one of his main mandates or a big priority to fight inflation, essentially giving a go-ahead to the U.S. Fed to do whatever it can to tame that inflation. So the Fed will continue. The ECB has now also veered towards a July hike, and the Bank of England has been doing it for a while. And in fact, they have said they can no longer guarantee that the UK economy cannot go into recession because of the interest rate hikes. So I think it's a real possibility on a 12 to 24 month period.
And speaking of the Bank of England, this week, Raymond, we saw Prince Charles sitting on a golden throne addressing the British public and saying, we're concerned about the fact that you can't pay for heating, or you are worried about putting food on the table. It had all the hallmarks of Marie Antoinette. What do you make of the outlook for global growth? Morgan Stanley forecasting this year that global growth is going to halve. The balance of risks seem to be now on the downside. How do you read it?
Hi, Michael. Well, let me just say immediately that if someone like Maynard Keynes was still around today and looking at Prince Charles on a golden throne, he would say that is a barbarous relic, which is the words that he used about the gold standard at the time. But just more seriously, I think, as my colleagues have said, clearly the central banks of the world are now seized with having to do something about global inflation. I think the caution is, don't just reach for page 101 of the economic textbook. You're dealing with a complex set of cross currents which differ from region and certain countries. And recently the IMF did produce a report saying, look, there are cross currents coming, they will be serious, but nonetheless, there's no one size fits all in regard to whatever might be decided by the central banks. It depends on your domestic economic circumstances. We must not have a mechanistic approach, bearing in mind we are now seized with this at a time when we've had to deal with pandemics, with war, with inflation. I think we're right to worry. Unfortunately, we may pay a price for the mistakes made by the Fed in not acting sooner. I recall we ourselves at a distance here in Johannesburg have already counseled months ago that the punch bowl had to be taken away by the Fed. Now we, of course, apart from what President Biden has said, this week also, of course, you will have noticed that Jerome Powell has been endorsed by the Congress. So they've aligned themselves with what the Fed, what its mandate is now, and indeed what it has to do. So I think that the balance of risks has certainly shifted negatively from a global point of view. And now much will depend on the pace at which interest rates rise in the United States, bearing in mind that there will be unintended consequences, especially for some of the emerging markets, including our own, who have already felt some impact in the exchange rate. So I think the overall picture is very much that the balance of risks have shifted to the possibility of a recession in a year or so in the United States. I wouldn't yet put it at over 50%, but it's getting closer to that number. So I think we must just build that probability or that risk into our assessment of where the global economy will go over the next year or so.
It certainly explains why we see such a bearish turn in markets lately and such extreme volatility, Warwick. I think that's certainly been the hallmark over the last few weeks. And the other major issue obviously being this stable coin issue, or you could call them unstable coins. Now, stable coins, as far as I understand them, and let's face it, I don't think many people fully understand the world of cryptos and DeFi yet, but are really pegged to an underlying physical currency like the US dollar, for example, and are meant to provide some kind of stability. So when you see one of those unpeg from its underlying and actually trade below that, one can understand why there was such a sell-off in response. But interesting to see that Janet Yellen telling congressional testimony, or giving congressional testimony yesterday, saying that I wouldn't characterize it at this scale as a real threat to financial stability, but they're growing very rapidly and they present the same kind of risks that we've known for centuries in connection with bank runs. So it does look like we're going to see increasing focus on how to regulate these.
Well, certainly, Michael, I mean, particularly along the lines of when you hold an asset, say it's forms part of a company's balance sheet, next thing you get a smack to a particular market and the financial stability is undermined. But I think in a broader context, let's consider this. It looks in a lot of ways just like the US car industry in the 1920s and 30s, the internet in the early 90s and noughties. You know, with something like this and a market like this, you need a process of standardization to lead to adoption, and often a big shakeout is a necessary prelude to that whole lot. I mean, in the case of these coins, what's going to cause it? Perhaps an extra supply. I mean, after all, there's literally thousands of these things, but that means that there's almost no hurdle to these coming in. So, of course, there's a continuous glut of these coins coming through. And the other issue as well, what about the actual standard of encryption on them and the stability of them from a security point of view? You know, what could the trigger be? Possibly developments in quantum computing? Maybe that's the thing that that triggers the consolidation.
Very interesting.
Maybe I can add something here, Michael.
Yes,
I think it almost rhymes with the early 2000s dot-com bubble. We can take it back over a century ago with the tulips, bubbles. Every time you have too much money that is being pumped into an economy, chasing too few goods, you have all sorts of bubbles forming in different parts of the markets. over the last decade, we've had a lot of money through QE from many central banks. In the last 2 years alone, $8 trillion of money was pumped into the economy to support the economy. And we've seen all these stable coins, which are now looks unstable, as per your characterization, appreciating in value. Now that we're getting central banks saying, hang on, we need to, take the foot off the pedal as far as liquidity is concerned, we see them tanking. I think we're likely to see a lot more before we get stability.
Very good point that, Isa. The money printing that we've seen has certainly led to bubbles all over the show, and it doesn't pass notice that you can't spell cryptos without cry. Raymond, if we want to cry even further, just look at the mining numbers that came out this week in the midst of the Cape Town mining indaba, a huge drop in the April mining figures, and it looks currently that mining will actually be detracting from first quarter GDP. So clearly, we asked last week, do we have a good story to tell investors based on this, based on these numbers? We certainly don't. What stood out for you during the mining in Darba this week, Raymond?
Well, I think we must say, Michael, that at this point, we are all going to have to trim our forecasts for the next 12 months or so in the light of not only what's happening, in fact, globally, but also whatever policy decisions we may still take here, including what we will do with our monetary policy in the months ahead, and especially with the next meeting of the Monetary Policy Committee next week. But standing back and looking at the debate at the mining indaba, I think in a way, if we really take it seriously, it's an important sector whose dynamics in a way hold up a mirror to what is happening in some other sectors of the economy. In other words, that agenda of the challenges and the opportunities really is reflected in many other sectors and what they're experiencing at the moment. In other words, I felt we were seeing that a lot of promissory notes have been offered on policy, but now they're starting to fall due. And the players are saying, well, why are they not being met? Mm-hmm. And why are they not being met more speedily? I think all the right noises have been made. As we said before, we're moving in the right direction. We're saying the right things again. The thing is to get the pace escalated. And I think the important point here is if we want opportunities and exploration in the mining sector to be expanded, especially given those opportunities in the global economy that we need to cultivate. As yeah. I said before, it's what we grow and what we dig up that's important, and we must be competitive. And I think the sort of basic message that comes out of the indaba is, look, here's a key sector. We need to respond more rapidly to the obstacles, to the red tape. In fact, I would say I hope that the red tape czar who's sitting in the presidency was watching that debate, because I think what was being said at the mining indaba must form part of yep. his agenda as well.
And as we know, Sipho Nkosi is not unfamiliar with the industry, having led Exxaro for several years. He's a mining entrepreneur of some note. And hopefully he is looking at that. And he's also looking at this mining catastrophe, because, Warwick, there's no country for all the mining cadastres. I mean, you can't. I mean, look at our history in awarding mining and prospecting rights. You just have to look at Imperial Crown Trading. Why can't we get this one off the ground?
There's a fabulous note by Hilary Joffe in recent press, but I think one can quite simply summarize it. I mean, as you point out, the industry needs a cadastre, so we need less cadres and more cadastre. I mean, what is a cadastre? It's basically a kind of a mapping system which identifies parcels of lands and mineral title and so on. And I mean, after all, you need that because most miners dig jolly great big holes in the ground.
and you need that security. It's like to Hilary Joffe's characterization in that excellent article, it's like the deed registry and having security over your house and your property. You're not going to have a successful mining industry with that. Before we go to the break, Isa, I just want to move on to what we saw with Operation Vulindlela this week. And it comes back to this broader discussion around reforms and promising reforms and promissory notes and time to cash in. 26 reforms, 8 of them so far, are completed, 9 on track full completion. Is that good enough? Is that fast enough? Clearly it isn't. But what more could Operation Vulindlela be doing?
Look, it's not fast enough. It's not good enough. But it is the nature of reforms that are structural, that requires a broad spectrum of, you know, role players to agree on before they can actually be delivered. You know, the big one that we really need to see is our electricity constraint. It's not possible to see, you know, a company coming to sink a mining shaft without being provided security of electricity. That's why, in part, we are not going to benefit as much from the mining sector, despite the global environment that continues to be quite beneficial for commodity prices. But I think, all in all, in my view, if you look over the last 3 to 4 years, we have moved in a positive direction. The direction is very clear, but given the urgency of how much we need investment and job growth, it's too slow for our liking.
And just quickly, Michael, I think the bottom line here is there must be a greater sense of urgency in the nice things we say and the important things that we want to do. A sense of urgency needs to permeate the debate to a much bigger extent.
We turn our attention now to yet another new social compact for South Africa. In his State of the Nation address in February, the President surprised everyone by announcing that a comprehensive social compact to grow our economy, create jobs and combat hunger would be finalized by NEDLAC within 100 days. Well, it's not quite clear exactly when the social compact or grand agreement should emerge from NEDLAC, but on the promised timetable, it should be within the next couple of weeks. So, Raymond, what must we expect here?
Well, Michael, as you may know, we've been talking about a social compact for quite a few years, going back to the foundation of NEDLAC, in fact. And although here and there we've struck various what I call bilateral agreements which look like a social compact, we've not been able to get to the point where you have a big overarching social compact between government, labor, business and other interested groups for all sorts of reasons which are locked into our political history. So I think what might emerge now in terms of what sort of social compact could we now visualize, it's now a question of, firstly, have the current challenges of South Africa now indeed concentrated everyone's mind wonderfully, because otherwise they may be hanged in a fortnight. We must get some things right jointly. Can we persuade the major stakeholders in NEDLAC to look beyond their own immediate interests and look more in terms of the broad natural interests? Can they walk that extra kilometer or mile in order to add value to the national interests as opposed to merely protecting their own interests? And then finally, is the institutional framework in South Africa strong enough to support the sort of social compact that has been successful in some other countries under the right conditions? We know that social cohesion is a big challenge in South Africa. I don't want to be a skeptic, but I think we'll have to wait and see whether by the end of the month or whenever that particular deadline will emerge, that there's a social compact in South Africa that will make a difference over and above the things we are already committed to doing and to implement.
And I am a cynic. I'm going to say I'm very skeptical about whether or not we're going to achieve it. But we have, Isaac, if you look back in the historical record in South Africa, the foundations of the industrialization of the South African economy built via Hendrik van der Bijl on an agreement between Anglo and Sishen supplying fairly cheap iron ore into Eskor. We had fairly cheap power, cost-plus mines, the coal that powered that industrialization, and also, and it must be said, large-scale exploitation of largely black labor. Now, obviously, those conditions have changed. We now have a democracy. We don't have an exploitative labor system. Sadly, we don't have a very reliable power system, and we don't have that sweetheart deal between Sishen and AMSA anymore. What are the conditions that you foresee for some grand compact to reemerge that everyone can walk forward in the national interest, to borrow what Raymond said?
Look, I think, there are many conditions that still are not met from a business side. From the other social partners in the presidency, there is a sense that they need a larger social wage, including a universal basic income grant, which seems to be a far-fetched idea, especially if we consider the pace of economic growth and what it will do to our fiscal. So essentially what business is asking for is guarantee fiscal sustainability, give us reforms on labor to make it much more easier for business to change its cost base as the economic cycle change to make sure that they continue to be sustainable and continue to implement the economic reforms in transport and other sectors of the economy that you have committed as government to be quite important for growth so that business can be more competitive in a global environment. Once those things are in place, perhaps business is going to agree to a higher social wage because it will be sustainable to pay for it. It seems for now we are still, miles apart such that the 21st of May deadline, if we consider, all days without having to take weekends, which is when the 100 days comes to an end, is not going to be met. Even when you don't consider weekends, you take it to end of June, it's unlikely to be met. And again, to Prof. Paisen's points, it may not be possible to agree on a grand social compact that is all-encompassing. Let's agree on the things that matter and then implement those things that we agree on. For instance, we know energy is important. Let's get it done. We know transport is important. Let's get it done instead of waiting for all the other things that we don't agree on.
Warwick, your thoughts on a grand social compact?
Look, I think my comment is really that, unlike a unipolar society like Japan or Germany, I mean, we're a diverse society, and the difficulty with diverse societies is that they are easily divided. So I guess some kind of compact in which you basically remind people to go back to basics and perhaps you're telling them to suck eggs a little bit, but you're also reminding them that you have to work through your differences and divisions to achieve bigger goals. So I can see where they're going, but I certainly agree with my colleagues that a sense of urgency on some of these tasks, especially since some of these tasks are like power solutions and so on, are more pure economic as opposed to social in nature.
Yeah, and what worries me, Raymond...
I may just quickly say, in a mischievous way, perhaps we should look for an implementation accord rather than a social accord. That's what we probably need at the moment.
But then, to come back to that, then we have a stumbling block implementation in our own regulators. You look at power, for example, where, yes, the self-generation cap was lifted to 100 megawatts, but now NERSA is making applicants jump through hoops that basically make that reform moot. So, there, again, isn't this coherence through government, and I know that's what Operation Vulindlela has been established to try and achieve, but it really needs to work harder on that.
Michael, perhaps I can remind you of a saying by Ronald Reagan that for every government policy, there's an equal and opposite action.
So true. Now, that leaves us then, finally, Isa, maybe you can just comment on this rail policy white paper that has been released against the backdrop of what we've discussed on the show in the past, a kind of failure to launch on the 1st of April that third-party access, and we know the commercial terms only offering access for 2 years, just wasn't commercially viable. Is this a real breakthrough now, having the white policy, the white paper?
Look, I think that the fact that we now have this white paper out for debate, where we will see the private sector responding to it, it's a good one. But I think we have to do it much faster than we have done so far, given how critical the transport sector, particularly rail is important to the agricultural sector, to the mining sector, and to the automotive sector, which are really quite big sectors of the economy that creates a lot of jobs and edge to economic growth. I think we just need to get the regulation done as soon as possible. I was hoping that it can be taken up from the highest office in the president to just make a decision, get reach a compact with big business, and implement.
Absolutely. I
think it's a very positive document, and the private sector should seize on it as well as the local authorities, to whom certain powers here will in fact be devolved. But I would also counsel, it's another promissory note that needs to fall due sooner rather than later.
We're dealing in promissory notes when we need to be dealing in hard action implemented on the ground. Until then, we certainly can't be applauding anything. That was Raymond Parsons, who was joined around the table by Warwick Lucas, head of Galileo Securities, and Izem Klunger, chief economist at Alex Forbes, putting your week into perspective.